91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program is about a little-known aspect of union organizing within South Florida service industry workers. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Union formation among Florida casino gambling interests is anathema, so legal union organizers must be furtive. A technique called salting is used, where pro-union personnel are embedded within the workforce. Journalist James Walsh secretly became a salt and wrote about it. We'll discuss his new book, Playing Against the Odds, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. Stay tuned. James Walsh joins us next on Topical Currents after the news. And we return on this Monday afternoon, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Today we delve into efforts to unionize service industry personnel at South Florida casinos in 2011. The methods of 21st union organizing are much different than from past eras.
So listen to how journalist James Walsh uses first-person reporting to write about union organizers called salts.
Bonnie, I'd never heard of such a thing.
No, nor had I.
Okay.
So a job site is salted when unions manipulate employers to unknowingly hire pro-union workers.
The salts, in turn, quietly urge key workers to support union elections. So we're now joined by James Walsh. His book called Playing Against the House, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer, is recent.
And it unfolds quite close to home. Welcome, James Walsh.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So listen, this was such an adventure, this book. I mean, you were a double agent, literally, for nearly 3 years. You were a salt for the union, which is undercover work, as we just said, but you didn't tell the union you were writing a book. So we'll get to a little more about that for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think if we could expand on salting a little bit more for our listeners, since neither of us had even heard the term.
Yeah, well, salting has been around since, for as long as organized labor has been around. We've found references to the Rochester Trades Council sending agents to non-union construction sites in as far back as 1860. So salting is certainly not a new concept, and it's something that both companies and labor unions know about. So the popularity of the tactic has kind of waned throughout the 20th century, but it's seen a little bit of a resurgence in the service industry in the past 15 years.
Where did the name come from? And also a touch on the legality of salting and how it stands with the National Labor Relations Board.
Sure. The name, I believe the first person to use the term salting was Henry Miller in the late 19th century. He was the first president of the Electrical Workers Union, and he...
Not the author.
No. not the author. He was the first person to call these underground organizers salts. But of course, as I mentioned, the tactic had been going on for years before that. And as far as the legality, it's perfectly legal. It was argued before the Supreme Court in 1995, because when it comes down to it, assault is sort of just a state of mind, right? It's somebody who gets hired and does the work just like everybody else, and organizes on the side, which you know, in the ruling, the Supreme Court justices said assault can serve two masters at once.
So I want to know why you took this on. How much did you know about unions? What made you want to do this?
I knew nothing about unions. My only frame of reference for unions was as a kid, the 94 baseball strike. And I got to college and met some activists who were kind of always the most dedicated people I knew. And they went after college and got hired at hotels, worked as bellmen and room service attendants trying to organize. And I went off and tried to, I went to journalism school, went to grad school. The tactic was, it was always something that intrigued me, but not necessarily something that I wanted to do. It's something I respected. I guess it was like jogging, I guess. You know, it's like, that's noble, but not really, you know, for me. And it wasn't until after grad school that, you know, I wanted to learn more about salting and why, really actually wanted to learn more about why workers weren't joining unions in droves coming out of the recession the way they had after the Great Depression, and what was slowing union growth.
So, well, tell us about the union you were working with, how you found Unite Here, how you found one another.
Sure. Yeah. I had friends who had salted for Unite Here. And, you know, I had originally, as a journalist, like I said, wanted to write about salting. But no union really likes to talk about salting.
So why did you write the book?
Yeah. I mean, I still don't really know why unions don't want to talk about salting, because I think it's something that campaign to campaign, the secrecy of the tactic campaign to campaign is important, but as far as the secrecy of the tactic, you know, throughout the country, I don't understand why that can't be talked about. So I went and told them that I wanted to salt, and that started, you know, my trajectory towards South Florida.
And why did they target the casinos at South Florida? Mm-hmm. Why was that in their, sure. What's that called? On a gun?
Game plan or sites.
In their sights. Yes,
right.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Well, the casinos, when they passed when they legalized slot machines, when Florida voters and county voters legalized slot machines in 2005 or 2006 in Broward, 2008 in Miami-Dade, in order to do that and the run-up towards that, the casinos wanted as much political capital as possible and entered these agreements with the union. And these agreements said, you know, you help us get slot machines and we'll remain neutral and, you know, let workers organize if they so choose to vote for the union. So that was sort of the way into the casinos, you know, that's why they were the targets.
Let's focus on the three South Florida institutions where you worked, or you didn't work there, but were the targets of the union. Calder, where you worked, the racetrack.
That's right.
And then Mardi Gras Casino, mm-hmm. which, of course, was formerly the Hollywood Dog Track. And then Magic City Casino, which is formerly the Flagler Dog Track. All these are really on the terms of racinos.
Exactly. They are the paramutuals that were dog tracks, horse tracks. There were also, you know, high life frontons that...
And the trotters,
yeah, exactly.
In the case of the Isle,
right. And they were the companies that first lobbied Tallahassee to try to legalize slot machines, and then lobbied Florida voters, and then lobbied county voters to open these casinos.
And of course, they were trying to battle the Seminole and Miccosukee mm-hmm. gambling
right.
institutions.
Exactly.
Now, why you say there isn't much of a wage differential between the union workers and the non-union workers in the casinos? Is
the
that
service,
right?
In the service.
In my experience, there is a difference. There's certainly a difference. I mean, nationwide, union workers, I think on average, earn something like 15% more
right.
Than their non-union counterparts. And that gap kind of also depends on the union density wherever you go. So, I mean, casino workers or service industry workers in South Florida that are non-union and union, it's a little bit closer than, say, a casino worker in South Florida against a casino worker in Las
right.
Vegas,
right.
Where it's the union density is very high.
But didn't you say that they do give time, without the union, they mm-hmm. gave pay time off, mm-hmm. 401ks, and health insurance?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what would be a motivation for them to sure. want to join a union?
Sure. Well, it should also be said that one of the biggest reasons that employers will offer these benefits is a deterrent to join the union. Okay. So without the union's presence, we don't really know what benefits would be offered to begin with. And in addition to that, many of my coworkers didn't, you know, take advantage of the health insurance because they didn't want to be given, they didn't have enough money to do that. And I don't think any of them would prefer really contributing to a 401k because they didn't have enough money at the end of the month for the 401k.
Especially if they had dependents.
Sure, exactly, exactly.
If it was for one person, it was a pretty good deal. But for families.
For insurance, I mean, for families, a lot of, you know, a lot of my, my coworkers had their kids on kid care, you know, rather than forking over the money to pay for the entire family.
I, you know, when I was reading this book, I found myself wondering how you were able to deceive both sides so successfully and play the both roles so well. I mean, wasn't it stressful and confusing?
I mean, there wasn't a lot of deception going on. You know, this is a long-term project. I was pretty much, I was always myself. I mean, my coworkers and my union organizers would recognize me. I am, you know, who I am. I carried a secret, you know, I carried, and that secret was simply that I journal, you know, every night. And as I will go home tonight and journal, you know, that's sort of, that secret can wear me down, and I'm not sure I would do a project like this again.
Of course, these people, though, that you were working with were really at-risk people. They had jobs, but very minimum paid job. Many were single parents, and to lose a job was really something traumatic to them. And you were in there without their knowledge, really gaining a lot of personal information about them, and essentially trying to get them to be pro-union.
Well, yeah, I mean...
That didn't haunt you at all?
No. As I say in the book, that 99.9% of my conversations and, you know, any SALT conversations are have nothing to do with the union. You know, I think...
But it was gaining trust for another purpose.
No, the origins of these relationships may have been calculated, but the relationships themselves were certainly genuine. You know, when you also have to remember, I was there for a very long time, working long shifts with these folks. You know, I was there all day, you know, every day. So there wasn't a lot of manipulation. There was no manipulation. It was just me getting to know my coworkers. And you know what? They complained about the money. They complained about, you know, the health insurance.
The treatment.
You know, there's not a lot of provoking to get somebody to do that. A lot of my coworkers didn't really know anything about unionization. So I felt like I was there simply just to be able to tell them about it. You know, it's sort of like just giving them a place to land.
You said some of them even thought they were in a union.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised when there was first talk of unionization at the casino. My coworkers came up to me. One said, you know, are we in a union? Another came up to me and said, is management going to be organized in the union? So I was lucky, and I felt lucky to be there to be able to provide some sort of information.
Okay, we're going to take a break, but I just have one more. Was your intention to help the low-wage workers improve their lives by unionizing to do this? Was it to expose the tactics of management to thwart the unions, or was it something else? Was it just to tell the story?
My intention, yes, was to tell the story.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. We're speaking with journalist James Walsh. This is his first book. It's called Playing Against the House, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. We'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and journalist James Walsh. We're talking about his book, Playing Against the House. Now, James, bring us up to date currently on the current status of unionization of all three venues.
Sure. As far as I know, two of the three casinos, Magic City and Calder, have been unionized, and Mardi Gras.
That service workers, which include housekeeping. And
sure. It's the housekeepers, the bartenders, the cooks, and some of the slot attendants as well.
You know, you had something in your book. We'll get to Sarah. I want to talk about some of these people, like Sarah and Dan Connolly and Kalia. But she said, you said you could, she would say things a lot of the time and you couldn't really fact check her to see if she was making it up. But she said that housekeepers are more prone to injury on the job and get more injuries than mine workers, which I really found surprising. Just talk.
Sure, yeah. I went and checked out the Department of Labor stats on that, and I'm not sure exactly the percentage. It wasn't a huge increase, but it was still shocking. And, I mean, housekeepers, you think about those best night sleep you've ever had mattresses and how heavy they are, that lifting, that pulling, all of that stuff can take a toll on the body. So they had a pretty high rate of injury on the job. Miners, you know, the percentage of union miners has, I think, gone down, but they've kind of had the union influence
right.
and protections for years. And I think that's had a huge impact on job safety. There is, to me, a correlation between the union and the ability to protect workers. And housekeepers have a much lower rate of unionization.
Well, let's talk about your passing muster to become a SALT and Sarah and Dan Connolly. Mm-hmm. Like, how did you, because they kind of were very happy to have you at a certain point.
Sure, yeah. They were enthusiastic about the SALT program and wanted me to move to Miami to work in the SALT program, and I did, and they wanted also to make sure I got hired, so they helped me to get hired and put my best foot forward, which I always say that
resumes and coaching.
Yeah, they were better job counselors than my college job, you know. Center.
But it was almost like being trained as a spy. I mean, you had to know how to answer questions, and you had to know, what you did before, and that you were, you know.
They kind of wanted me to play this role as sort of the Mad Men era white guy wearing a suit and making sure I was cleanly shaven, and I did that, and they were right. I got interviews and got hired at all three of the casinos we were talking about.
But you didn't tell them you had a college degree. Because that would flag them.
I did tell them. I actually did. My college degree was on my resume. I didn't put my graduate degree.
It was his
degree.
Graduate
yeah.
degree.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, speaking of being a white guy and getting hired mm-hmm. by these three places, were you surprised at all the racism, the color lines that still exist in
sure.
in the casinos?
Sure. I mean, surprised, whether it was surprising or not, it's always shocking to see that.
Yeah.
I worked in the restaurant at Calder, and we had all white servers, and then next door in the buffet were all pretty much all black and Haitian American servers, and I was shocked by that. And I don't think anybody sits down and says, okay, well, this is where we're going to put the white servers, and this is where we're going to put
right.
the black servers, but there certainly weren't any policies in place to prevent that kind of segregation.
And then what you did was you decided you were going to
sure.
be the only white person to work on the buffet.
Well, the high-end restaurant closed, and I was moved to the buffet, and I was the only white guy there for a long time. And it was important. My organizer kind of encouraged me to just come out and say, hey, I know I get preferential treatment. I know, you know, I work all the parties that kind of have good payouts and everything. I know that. And doing that went a long way with my coworkers. They kind of were much more open with me moving forward after that.
Was there a lot of racial tension, though? I mean, does there exist a lot of racial tension in the casinos because of that? Because of those color lines?
Sure. I mean, anytime you have a staff of black and Haitian workers and maybe not getting the respect that they deserve. I'm not sure what you mean exactly by racial tension, but there's
well, like, are the the waiters in the restaurant, in the high-end restaurant, is there tension between them and the Haitian and black workers on the buffet?
Yeah, I don't know if my white coworkers so much even knew that my black and Haitian coworkers were aware of the fact that all the white servers were getting the fancy parties. Mm. And as far as racial tension, you know, if you just come out and say it to your buffet coworkers, you know, that pretty much did away with any kind of tension between us.
So talk about your primary responsibilities. So you're hired as a salt, mm-hmm. and Sarah does a lot of training, mm-hmm. and Dan. And what were your responsibilities?
Yeah, I mean, number one is to do my job. You know, I was a buffet server, I was a bartender, and I, you know, wanted to make sure I was doing my job as best as possible, because that's what's most important, you know, and proving to your coworkers that you're a good worker. And then the most important part of any unionization campaign is finding leaders. So I would want to hang out with my coworkers as much as possible, get to know them, and find out who's the most respected person in the buffet or in the groups of friends. We called it mapping, and mapping kind of looked like these web ideas that you would do as a kid in middle school, kind of to outline an essay or something. And if you, I say that, you know, if you ask a seventh grader to map the social cliques in the seventh grade, you'd be halfway to unionizing it, because that's really how you understand a workplace, is to map it.
One thing we haven't talked about that's an element in this is the practice of, or the policy of card checking in union, mm-hmm. and how that figured into what you did.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, in the run up to the slot machine legalization 2006 and 2008, the union and the casino entered these agreements called card checks, in which they agreed to not be either pro-union or anti-union. Now, as soon as slot machines were legalized, each of the casinos in their own way tried to get out of their card checks using various legal arguments.
That was to get labor support at the polls.
Well, sure, right. Exactly. You know, they want to signal to voters that, hey, these are going to be good middle class or working class jobs, and at least have the potential to be unionized. But once they did get what they wanted, which was slot machines legalized, they came out and went to the court and tried to challenge these agreements to try to get out of them. They never won those challenges. But then again, they also realized that the consequences of maybe being anti-union aren't necessarily as great as the consequences of unionization. So they were openly pretty antagonistic.
So you might have some settlements with individuals, but you don't have the overall
right.
$2 or $3 more per employee per hour,
right.
and the benefits that would be that they'd have to pay for.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when I went into this, I thought, okay, they've agreed to be neutral. They agreed to take a step back and let my coworkers choose whether or not they wanted to join a union, and that just was not the case at all.
And if you would ask them, they would say they are neutral. Or they were.
Yes, or they would say they're challenging the legality of the card check agreement in court. What I saw was that, you know, if my coworkers were asked in this neutral environment whether or not they were pro-union, they would inevitably say yes. You know, how could I not be pro-union? It means a couple extra dollars for me. And like many Americans who are pro-union, but they weren't given the choice of whether or not they wanted to join the union, because they were either scared to be fired or they were fired.
I want to go back to the leader thing. That was one of your primary responsibilities, mm-hmm. is finding leaders at the workplace. But how did you know when you found somebody who you determined was a leader that they weren't going to go back and work with management?
Well, that's part of trying to find the right leader.
you
know,
yeah.
One of the key points is trying to recognize that person's relationship with management.
We're going to take another break right now, and this interesting discussion with journalist James Walsh about his debut book, Playing Against the House, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. We'll be right back.
And we're back at today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're talking with journalist James Walsh about his book, Playing Against the House, which takes place in South Florida at three casino establishments. And James, run down the tactics that each of the venues had against unions. And of course, the Calder area did go with union while you were there.
Actually, that was after I had left that they went union. But at first, when the casinos found out that the union was coming and knocking on coworkers' doors, they would have these, what are called, they would have these meetings in which the management, usually the president of the casino, would come and say, hey, you know, I believe unions had their place. They had their time when, you know, they got child labor laws. They got you your 40-hour work week. They got you, you know, all these things. But now you are treated pretty well. We provide the 401k. A former president of Calder even said, you can keep contributing to that 401k and you will be sipping, you know, cocktails on a beach in the Bahamas one day.
right.
My coworkers just kind of nodded their heads. Then they would change and say, well, if you join the union, you're probably going to lose all those benefits, not mentioning that the union would replace them or, you know, most likely would replace every benefit that they supposedly lost. The union will drive a wedge between management and the employees. And even went so far as to say, hey, if you don't want these union people coming and knocking on your door, we encourage you to call the police. They're trespassing, which we would always laugh at because you don't call the police when the Girl Scouts come or when, you know, you have a Jehovah's Witness.
They stressed teamwork and solidarity. What was one of the interesting uses that one of the tracks used about how, you know, we're all in this together for a great experience?
Sure,
like
yeah.
That.
There is this sort of kind of Orwellian language going on in the casino. You know, we don't like they and them. We like we. You know, we don't like bosses or managers. We like leadership. You're not in the service industry. You're in the industry of providing winning experiences.
Winning experiences. Yes.
Winning that experiences.
Because it ties into the gambling.
Exactly. Yeah.
So now, technically, you couldn't be fired for being assault, but you could be fired for being whatever they wanted to drum up.
Right. Yeah. Of course, under the National Labor Relations Act, companies are not allowed to fire someone for being pro-union. Now, in the service industry, where the turnover is so high and there are so few protections, that doesn't prevent companies from saying, hey, Colette, one of my coworkers, assault, you're a cocktail waitress and you were caught loitering.
We're
going to fire you for that. And by the time they got to me and fired me, it was, hey, James, you've been here for under your 90-day probationary period. After 2 months, we've done this evaluation and we're going to fire you, but we don't need to give you a reason.
Well, you know, that's another thing that I was thinking of. Florida is a right-to-work state,
right,
also.
Right.
And there's that Supreme Court case, which is still pending, which is going to be strange now because
we don't really know what's going to happen.
We don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. But it could weaken unions across the country.
Sure, yeah. Public sector unions could be weakened. Yeah, I mean, right to work, as one side likes to call it, and right to freeload, as unions like to call it, been around since Florida, I believe, was, I think, the first state to be right to work.
Probably.
And what that means is in a union shop, workers don't have to pay union dues to be given all of the benefits that the union negotiates on behalf of those workers. And I saw this in the workplace.
Found people like
that. Sure. While a lot of my coworkers didn't know about unionization, I had one coworker come right up to me and say, listen, the union is a good thing. We want the union here, but don't sign that card, because you will have to pay dues, and we don't even have to pay dues, and we still get it all. And I was just blown away. And in one sense, you know, it goes against everything I kind of like, you know about personal responsibility and citizenship. But in another sense, I understood she was working a low-wage job. She had kids she needed to take care of. So, you know, if she doesn't have to pay dues, why is she going to?
Exactly.
Most of these people are a paycheck away from being really broke.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, that the dues make a difference. And that's kind of what lawmakers and those who want to see the demise of unions see in Right to Work, is that it's a way to weaken unions in this very insidious way.
I'll just say for the record that that case that's pending before the Supreme Court is Friedrichs versus mm-hmm. California Teachers Association.
Exactly. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in the conversation with James Walsh, he's the author of Playing Against the House. It's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
I enjoyed the part in the book where you tell the story of Herbert Pinky Schiffman in terms of union history a little. Mm-hmm. Talk about him.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't a lot written about the history of labor unions and the service industry union in South Florida. So I had to do some digging and came across this guy, Herbert Pinky Schiffman, who was kind of this old school.
Sounds a little shifty.
This old school union organizer. A lot of people talk about the history of corruption through the 20th century, and while Pinky had some skeletons in his closet, I don't think anything, you know, he didn't really hold a flame to the kind of crazy stories you might hear from other big major union leaders. But he did get in some trouble in one campaign when after workers at hotels on South Beach went on strike. Many of the workers were not rehired after the strike, and Pinky was the target of a car bomb, which I think was pretty much, you know, in vogue in Miami at the time.
What year was that?
Ooh, I'd have to double check.
Yeah, I don't
late
remember.
60s or early okay. 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. But some of the people you were working with, you really became friends with and you really liked. Like Erica, you really liked.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as I said, these relationships were genuine friendships. You know, I went bowling. I went to, you know, a new age kind of Buddhist ceremony. I went to church. I went to the batting cages. I went to all of these places with these coworkers and really got to know them. And many of them, you know, even after I knew they weren't leaders, you know, I knew they weren't really essential to our campaign. But yet, of course, these relationships kind of crossed that threshold into genuine friendships.
By the way, journalist James Walsh, his book is Playing Against the House, A Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. He will be at Books and Books in the Gables tonight at 8 o'clock.
It's on Aragon Avenue.
Aragon Avenue, right. The Gables Books and Books. So talk about Wendy Walsh.
Sure. She was the president of the local down here at the time. You know, she was the union leader, one of the sharpest people I met while I was working down here, and kind of brilliant in reviving this service industry labor union in South Florida that kind of had been a punching bag over the past, you know, 20 years.
And why had it been a punching bag? We didn't really touch on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, a complicated history, but the union certainly didn't do enough after Pinky Schiffman's departure to attract the kind of attention and membership that a lot of other locals around the country were doing. And the sophistication of the, it should be mentioned, the sophistication of the service industry corporation's tactics in keeping workplaces union free and even getting rid of the union is unrivaled in many other industries.
Talk about some of the ways they did that.
Yeah, sure. You know, if they, if let's see, if if the hotel would, you know, I'm not a labor historian, but if a hotel sees an opportunity to, you know, if workers go on strike, they can wait a strike out and hire non-union workers to replace them. I mean, there's all sorts of tactics, but through right-to-work laws, through these illegal firings, there's just plenty of ways that these corporations can keep the union out.
And didn't you say at times they would say they're going to remodel or something?
Right, yeah. So why not close? We can close the hotel.
They'd rather close the hotel.
Remodel, get rid of the workforce, and come back union-free when that contract has expired.
Tell me, James, what would the organizers who headed Local 355 have thought had they known when you began salting that you were a journalist and writing a book?
You know, you'd have to ask them. I'm not going to put thoughts into their, you know, or words into their mouths, but I can tell you that they probably would not be excited about a book about salting.
So have you had a reaction from the union? I know the book just came out,
right?
Yeah, it
just came out. No,
yeah,
no.
Like I think the 16th.
Last week, yeah. Last Tuesday, sure.
Yeah, so we'll wait and see. So why do you think it was so much easier at Calder to unionize than at Mardi Gras? Why was Mardi Gras so tough?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know the details. As I said, Calder happened after I left. Mardi Gras, from the beginning, was very antagonistic towards unionization. There was kind of a history of antagonism before we even started our campaign. And we formed a leadership committee of 15 union leaders, and of the 15, 10 were fired. And what that does is just scares the rest of the workforce. I, you know, vividly remember visiting one waiter after only two people had been fired, and I could see him shaking, you know.
Wow.
And he wasn't somebody who would shake at work, you know. He was a very confident guy, and he just said, "They know you're here." And we said, you know, "No, they don't know we're here." And he just didn't want to talk to us at all. He said, "I know the union is a good thing, but they know you're here, and I don't want anything to do with
you." But then you ended up taking the parent company to court at Mardi Gras.
Well, we brought the charges to the National Labor Relations Board and went through the entire process of trying to win remedies. And 8 of the 10 workers that were fired ultimately were proven to have been fired because of their union affiliation.
And were rehired.
The 6 were offered their jobs back, and they've so far have refused to rehire the two of us that were salts.
Meaning Colette.
Yes.
So you declined to take the job.
I haven't gotten the job offer.
They didn't take him back.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's still. I mean, there was some sort of filing last week, which is not publicly available online.
But they made an overture to you or something, of saying, "What would you think about coming back?"
The labor board.
Like
yeah.
Let's take a call, and then we'll come back. Steve in Miami. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I was working at Mardi Gras. So I know James, and I was fired. I was among 10 workers fired in November 2011. I was offered my job back. I didn't take it, but I just wanted to make the point. I haven't heard the whole show. I'm not sure if you touched on this, but the NLRB did rule in our favor, 8 of us.
We just did.
Yeah.
Right.
We just did. But
okay.
Let me ask you something. Why didn't you take your job back?
I have another job.
Ah. Okay.
Is it in the same industry?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Hmm. James, any comment?
No. I mean, Steve, you know, I know, you know, it was a great, you know, part of our union leadership committee and was fired for the reason of talking to a coworker about the union. And they tried to justify in court that he had gotten in the way.
They're saying they're wasting company time talking about the union.
Yeah, and it's you can imagine all the conversations you have throughout the day with your coworkers. Not one of those interferes with their work. So I don't understand why having a conversation about a union gets in the way of the work.
But I would just like to add that Mardi Gras is still pending. We still plan to organize there. So we're not giving up on that in any way.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. Thanks,
Steve. You're very welcome.
We're speaking with journalist James Walsh about his book, Playing Against the House, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. Our last break. We'll be back.
And it is Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with journalist James Walsh about his book, Playing Against the House, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. And once again, James Walsh will be appearing at 8 p.m. tonight at Books and Books in Coral Gables. James, could you touch on the man that you called Alex in the book? I'm not sure if that's his real name or not, but the local leader, your relationship with him. And he was also the one that you finally had to tell that you indeed had been writing a book during your entire SALT career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alex was, again, one of those people you meet and think, how are unions not getting organized quicker, because he's, you know, one of those, he's burning the midnight oil, working so hard for unionization. We met on a weekly basis and developed a pretty great relationship throughout that time, kind of mentoring me as an organizer. You know, I wanted to get in the role of an organizer. And eventually, yeah, it came time for me to come clean about my intentions to write a book. I hadn't written the book completely yet. We didn't really see eye to eye on the value of having the story out there.
What was the most important, or what are the most important, if there are more than one, takeaways for you from this experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that the challenges that unions face in new organizing efforts, especially in the service industry, you know, like I said, you know, a majority of Americans support unions and workers' right to organize. So why are only 11% of workers organized, and only, I think, 6% in the private sector? Why? And what I found was because this sliver of lawmakers and lobbyists are so good at keeping workplaces union free. It wasn't that my coworkers didn't want to unionize; it was that they couldn't unionize.
But didn't you also find in writing this book that a lot of these wounds were inflicted by the unions themselves through there was so much corruption in them at a certain point, you know?
You know, yeah. I mean, the unions certainly have self-inflicted wounds from the, throughout the 20th century. But I certainly didn't encounter, that wasn't the problem that the union had in South Florida.
With Unite Here.
No. You know, it might be a different story at a different union. This is the story of, you know, this union trying to organize the service industry.
Are you in touch with anybody from Unite Here still?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I still have a few friends who work for the union, but not so much, you know, in South Florida. Maybe, you know, after some time, or if they've had a chance to read the book,
maybe they'll be glad.
Yeah, we'll see.
What is that union? What does that mean, Unite Here? When did that? I mean, like, you hear of all these unions. Mm-hmm. I never heard of Unite Here.
Yeah, it was two different unions that merged, I think, in 2004. It was the hotel workers and the needle trade workers. And the needle trade workers had a lot of resources, but of course...
The needle trade?
Yeah, you know, seamstresses.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, had a lot of resources, but a lot of those jobs had, you know, gone abroad. The hotel workers had a lot of workers to organize, but not a lot of resources. So they were this kind of match made in heaven, and they merged in 2004.
Go over briefly the trial that you had with the NLRB mm-hmm. against the Mardi Gras organization.
Mm-hmm. Right. The NLRB doesn't represent the workers in the case. They represent, you know, the government going ahead and bringing charges against Mardi Gras. And it was a pretty fascinating process, as where, you know, union discrimination is not under, you know, you can't hire your own lawyer and say you discriminated against me because I'm pro-union.
It's not like EEOC.
Exactly, exactly. Instead, you know, the NLRB represents the government. And so what I found was, you know, the process worked. From the time I got fired to the judge's decision, you know, it was probably, I think, 10 months. Since then, Mardi Gras and their lawyers have been able to delay with appeals. And so, you know, I was fired in November 2011, and here we are in 2016. Mm. The case is still, you know, being appealed.
So that's the risk, because for some of these people, because if you can be fired, for they can don't even need a reason really here, but if you can be fired, look at the number of years somebody would be out of work.
Sure, you could be out of work, or you can, you know, scare the bejesus out of the coworkers and keep a shop union free. That, you know, we had 15 leaders back in the fall of 2011, and now 10 of those leaders, after 10 of those leaders being fired, I think one coworker has actually taken the job or is still back at work. So, yeah.
Well, we have
decimated.
Just about a minute or so, a couple of minutes. What do you want to happen from this book? If you could have your way with it, mm-hmm. what do you want it to accomplish?
Yeah, this is a book, as I said, I didn't know anything about unionization. This is not a deep dive into unions written for union people. This is something that I think anybody can see, that these stories are human stories, from management to workers to coworkers and organizers. And I hope that people can read it and kind of have a better sense of the state of unions in the service industry in America right now.
Which you do think have a place in the 21st century.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with journalist James Walsh. He's on the editorial staff at New York Magazine. His work has appeared on the websites of The New Yorker, Esquire, and Global Post. This is his first book. It's Playing Against the House, The Dramatic World of an Undercover Union Organizer. And again, he will be at Books and Books and Carl Gables tonight at 8 p.m. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Topical Current's lead producer is Richard Ive. Today, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. And join us tomorrow when we focus on two areas of Florida's criminal justice system. We'll look at efforts to end the practice of youthful convicted offenders housing within adult prisons. Also, discussion of another prison reform issue, having prisoners deemed to be severely mentally ill locked up in the general population. As always, if you didn't get to hear all of the program, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And of course, we have more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page, including links, photos.
It's facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
Drop us a like. This is Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned next for Here and Now from NPR News.